When Edward Ball was growing up, his father told him there were five things they didn't talk about in the Ball family: religion, sex, death, money, and the Negroes. The Ball family had been a slave-owning family before the Civil War. They once controlled a slave dynasty. Edward Ball knew a lot about his family, but never knew much about the slaves they owned. He says he felt accountable for what happened and compelled to try to explain it. He spent years researching his family history. He also found several descendants of the slaves owned by his family. He's written a new book called Slaves in the Family. I asked Edward Ball to give us a sense of his family's plantations before the Civil War.
The Balls, for five generations, managed rice plantations. Over the course of 167 years, between 1698 and 1865, they enslaved about 4,000 people on plantations which were between 1,000 and 2,000 acres in size, north of Charleston, South Carolina. So it was a big business. By the same token, dozens of other families in the area were in the same business. It wasn't just the Balls, and across the South there were thousands and thousands of cotton planters and rice planters.
Now, you estimate that by the year 2000, there will be at least 75,000 living descendants of former slaves from Ball plantations.
That's right, yes. At least 75,000, perhaps closer to 100,000.
It's kind of overwhelming, isn't it?
It's a lot of people. They live all around the country. But the secret of this story is that some of them live next door. In other words, Americans have these strange and vexed connections to each other that link us through the past. In New York, for example, I went to a meeting of a black genealogy group and discovered that the woman sitting next to me was descended from a Ball family slave. And it's sort of like that. The descendants of the slaves live all around America, just as the Balls do.
From your research and your interviews with members of the Ball family, what images do you think the Ball family had of itself as slave owners?
Well, there were two central themes of our family's portrait of itself. One was that the Balls did not separate slave families by selling people, by selling children away from their parents, by selling husbands away from their wives. And the other was that the Ball men did not sleep with the black women whom they owned. And I went about my research, digging through the records that our family had kept and that later ended up in libraries around the South, some 10,000 pages of account books and diaries and lists of slaves and wills and so forth, and gradually pieced together a portrait that was somewhat different from the one that our family tended to believe in. It did happen that our family sold children away from their parents and husbands away from their wives, and it did happen that the Ball men slept with the women that they enslaved. It didn't happen all the time, but nevertheless it did happen.
Would you compare the stories that the Ball family tells about itself with the stories about the Ball family that you heard from descendants of slaves that were owned by the Ball family?
I heard a range of stories from the descendants of the slaves. I did hear stories about beatings that individuals suffered, stories of which were handed down to living descendants. And of course, I heard stories about what we call miscegenation in that sort of quaint old term. But what surprised me was that from some families I heard other kinds of stories, namely that after freedom, the Balls encouraged some of their slaves, probably the people living in the house, to go to school and to get educated. And once in a while, Mr. Ball, on one or two of the plantations, would help the freed people with their school lessons. This I heard from the mouths of the descendants of the slaves. And so it's a contradictory legacy.
What did your family do after slavery when plantations couldn't be run on slave labor anymore?
Many of them tried to become sharecroppers, setting up rice operations in the same places and in the same fields with freed black labor. Freed people had very few choices about where to sell their labor power, and maybe half of the emancipated slaves stayed right there where they had formerly lived, working for the Balls. But they could not be made to do the things that they had done in the past, because one of the unspoken and sometimes written aspects of the arrangement was that whipping was no longer allowed. And so people worked at the pace that they wanted to work, and rice itself as a commodity was more cheaply produced elsewhere. So the Ball plantations dwindled very quickly after the Civil War. And by 1890, whereas the family had owned 9 places at the end of the fighting, we owned maybe 3. And by 1910, rice was completely finished as an economic opportunity, and the Ball sold off the rest of their land and moved to the city of Charleston to take up jobs in the middle class.
You know, it seems to me that your exploration of your past is like the inverse of Roots, because you're researching something in your family history that you're not particularly proud of, the legacy of slaveholding. I mean, usually when people research their past, it's with the expectation they're going to take great pride in these accomplishments and this connection with history. And it's a part of history that is very problematic that you're connecting with.
Sure, but it would be a mistake to say that I feel shame about my family. If I felt shame, I would be cowering behind a closed door, and instead what I'm doing is coming forward publicly to talk about this most difficult part of American history. In some ways, I'm very proud of my family, an early colonial family. We fought in the American Revolution. We fought in the Civil War. We kept records of all of our doings for 200 years. But I think that I am accountable for the cruelty that my family participated in. I don't believe I'm responsible for the Ball's slave-owning past, but I'm accountable for it, and I'm trying to explain it and talk about it to others.
There was a beach near where you grew up in South Carolina that I think was a landing point for many people who were taken from Africa to be sold into slavery.
I lived for a couple of years on a place called Sullivan's Island, which is a 4-mile-long sandbar at the mouth of Charleston Harbor. And between 1700 and 1800, it was the main landing site for slave ships coming from Africa to North America. Some 40% of the Africans brought to what would become the United States came here via Sullivan's Island and Charleston. So that means nearly half of black Americans today had an ancestor who set foot for the first time on American soil on this sandbar. And there were these quarantine houses called pest houses where the slaves were sequestered for 3 weeks before they were sold in Charleston. And all of this, I had no idea about this while living on the island as a child. And as an adult, it was a long time before I learned about it. But what we're looking at is an island that is a kind of memorial and monument to this disastrous chapter in American history. On the island itself, there's no monument or plaque or any recognition of this past whatsoever.
Would you like to see something erected there?
Well, I would. I think it would be appropriate. It is a fact that Ellis Island was the gateway for some 40% of Americans to this country. And we make quite a big deal about Ellis Island. I think it would be important to have some memorial of some kind. I mean, but the fact is that we, as a nation, have tried to erase most remnants of the history of slavery because we're not sure how to process it. And if we were to begin to pay attention to it, there would be memorials of all kinds throughout the South.
My guest is Edward Ball. He's the author of Slaves in the Family. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Edward Ball, author of Slaves in the Family, a history of his family, which owned large plantations before the Civil War and controlled a slave dynasty. I'm wondering if any of the descendants of slaves who you met were actually named Ball.
Some of them were, not many at all. In coastal South Carolina, it wasn't the pattern that people took the name of the former slave owner. And in fact, what motive would they have for taking the name of their former master? At the end of the Civil War, they had the choice of a surname, and most chose names that came from 10 or 20 miles away. There is family tradition in the Ball family that that the patriarch of the family at the time asked the black people not to take the name Ball, and so that might have influenced their decision. So maybe 1 out of 20, 1 out of 50 took the name Ball.
Why did they ask that?
Well, it was the beginning of that process of forgetting. I think that the family would have been uncomfortable knowing that there were a lot of African-American families named Ball out there, and they might have even felt that this insinuated that there had been sex between the slave owners and the women in slavery.
You met at least one person who you figure is probably a blood relation, probably one of the Ball family members, had sex with one of the slaves that they owned. At least that's a story that was handed down through the African-American family. Tell me about one of the people who you met like this and what the encounter was like.
Well, I should say that white and black sex was a rare but persistent occurrence on the plantations. It happened more in Virginia, and it happened a great deal more in Louisiana, where there were institutions set up for bringing white men together with black women. But down home on the Ball lands, there was a man called Peter Pius, who was a member of the Ball family on a place called Limerick Plantation in the 1820s, who had a mistress named Diana. And their child, Frederick Pius, was born on the plantation. And the descendants of Frederick Pius number about 50 people who live in South Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. The woman that you mentioned is named Carolyn Goodson, I think, and she lives in Philadelphia. And I visited her for the first time a year or 2 years ago. And when I got to her door, she embraced me as though I was a long-lost sibling, which in some ways I must have been. And she has expressed nothing but affection for me.
In the course of the research for this book, you connected with several African-Americans who were the descendants of slaves that had been owned by your family. Did you apologize? Did you ask for forgiveness? Do you feel like forgiveness is something that could be even granted?
I have apologized to two different families that I've spent time with, not to all of the families, because I think that an apology is an important gesture, and I also think that it should not be superficial. Part of the legacy of slavery is that whites, not just the descendants of slave owners, but all whites, are members of a caste that has greater privilege than black Americans who are members of a different caste. And by reaching out to individual families, I've tried to lessen that separation somewhat. I also think that an apology is not something that I can, or that white Americans or even the government give to black Americans or to black individuals. That's really the wrong way around. Although it has made a difference in the lives of the people to whom I've apologized, it's also true that an apology does more for white people than it does for black, because it allows us the opportunity to acknowledge that our history has been at least as marked by the legacy of slavery as the lives of black people have been marked by it.
Well, I think what you're saying, too, is that, you know, it's a white person gets forgiveness if it's asked for, but what does the black person get? I guess an acknowledgement of the suffering.
Right. Well, it's not a deal. And for me, if the only thing I've done is to touch the lives of a few dozen black folks, then I think that I've done something, and I'm satisfied with that.
How does the rest of your family feel about your book and your apologies?
I would be dishonest if I didn't say that this project has divided the family.
Mm-hmm.
It has aroused a lot of emotion in the family. Some of it is good and some of it is unhappy. I have nothing but affection for those in the family who have resisted this project, because what I am doing, what I have done, is to rewrite a story that all of us have learned since childhood, and I'm sure that must be painful, and I regret that, but I think that our story as a family is a rather small fact, and the story of the plantations we owned is a rather large fact. In other words, it's much bigger than we are. It's much more important than we are. And I think for those reasons, it has been necessary to tell the bigger story.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with
sure,
us.
Sure. My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Edward Ball is the author of the new book, Slaves in the Family.